So the instruments that you are seeing are, of course, not entirely originally from India, because what you're seeing here in front of me is an organ, which came from the West originally. But then it went down to the floor. Instead of like pedals like we had in the West traditionally, in India it became simplified, and gradually the organ went down to the floor with a simple handle for pumping like this, but it maintained the keyboard, which is the same as our Western keyboard. So that way we play, and I must say, I don't play entirely Indian style. There is a little bit of a Western touch in there. What can I do? It's still in the blood. It doesn't go away. We have on the drums, these drums, this is a two-headed drum, also not entirely traditional, because the traditional ones are made of clay. But clay drums coming all the way from India and surviving all the way to Australia is not easy, and then once they're here, they usually break in the first week. So therefore we have those, but we keep them locked up and don't bring them out, locked up in a glass case. So this one is made of good old solid fiberglass, right? Nothing ever goes wrong with that. You can bounce it on the ground and it bounces right back up. And still, but it still has the effect of the traditional drum with two heads, one for the bass, dum, 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 and the higher one, tick, 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 tick. And there are many, many different bowls, as they say, different mantras that are produced with these instruments. And all that is part of an ancient music. The first time I was introduced to Indian music was in that concert that George Harrison organized for Bangladesh. At that time he had invited Ravi Shankar. There were big floods in Bangladesh and they were trying to raise funds. And then he introduced Ravi Shankar, and who was going to play sitar. And he said that the music that we are playing here this evening is now a little different than the normal music we're used to in the West. It is of a more serious nature. And then it started, Ravi Shankar started to produce certain sounds, and afterwards there was a big applause, and Ravi Shankar said, "If you like the tuning so much, then I'm sure you're going to love the concert." That's how it was introduced. So little did anyone understand anything about music from India. But it is true that it is of a more serious nature, because there is a meditational aspect to it, and all the different melodies are based on old ragas. So actually what is placed, these are not just anyone's concoctions, but they're traditional musical arrangements on which these songs are being sung. And they all have a different mood, naturally. Music always has its own mood. But then all these ragas are having different moods and are meant for different times of the day, and like there are morning ragas, right? Very light, and you know, just to kind of slow to break into the day. Evening ragas, a little more passionate, like that. Each time of the day has its own nature. Morning in the Vedic time is considered to be the hour for peaceful meditation. So morning time, everything is very peaceful and calm, and then as the day catches up, then passion sets in. And the evening is just to forget all the busyness of the day, to get it off your mind. The mind is full, and now we want to relax. So these natural tendencies are there in everyone, and we recognize it also in our own culture, in our way of life. The morning, we're fresh, we absorb things. In the day, it gets really busy. And at night, you just want to switch off and let go and put your mind on something else and take it off the work of the day. So in this way, the music, the ragas, have been designed for these different moods at different times. So like we can sing the same song, we do it again, but this time we're going to do it now in the evening tune. What we did was the morning one, so we'll give you a demonstration of the evening one. Same song, but with a little different mood, as you could see. A little faster, a little more life. Of course, we can drag it on this, and we can get more instruments also. We forgot some of the instruments, to tell you the truth. We have usually some cymbals also to add to the rhythm. So now it's just clapping. So that was a little bit of our demonstration of chanting. It can be done in traditional tunes, or it can be done also in more modern tunes. This is when East came West. The Eastern mantras stayed the same, but a little bit, a few Western chords came in, and the mood changed a little bit. But that's okay, because one cannot once. We were in a university, and the introduction was that here is a living time warp. A living time warp, an amazing experience. Here is an extinct creature. Look at it, right? Check it out. A dress of thousands of years ago, standing here right in the middle of us, modern man. Right? Here we have him, an extinct species. Someone, a contemporary of the dinosaurs, has now appeared amongst us. But if we look a little closer, he's not that old-fashioned. There are glasses. They didn't have those. No dinosaurs with glasses, right? Watches, etc. So, and we see microphones are being used. So we see a blend of both worlds. In that way, not actually a living time warp, but certain elements from a tradition maintained and now expressed in a modern society and culture. So before I continue speaking, I'm going to come up, because it has two advantages. One, it's good for my back, and also I've been in the car and in the plane and everything today, so I definitely would like to stretch up a bit. And the other thing is, then you will be able to see me. That will also help. Okay. I'm kind of the informal type, so I prefer to just sit in front of the thing than to stand behind it, if you don't mind. It feels more natural and more human. I feel kind of an alien when I stand behind that thing. So if you don't mind, we'll just speak like this. So we are here seeing when I first saw Hare Krishna, I definitely had the opinion that I was dealing with aliens. It was in my hometown, and this gray Bedford van pulled in, and a door flapped open, and many little pink men came out. Too many. Too many. So my conclusion was, something fishy here, watch out. Right? And I moved over to one side of the sidewalk, and then they came in my direction, and I managed to get into a shop. Oh, it was close. And then someone said, it's a dangerous sect, right? Well, you know, it didn't surprise me at all. I definitely suspected that that was the case. So my first encounter was that, and there was immediate suspicion. It was normal. But then later, I traveled to India. And when I traveled to India, I saw many things in India. I saw so many different temples with so many different statues inside, and so much worship going on every street corner. And then I went to the holy river in Benares, and I saw many priests sitting there under straw parasols with different colors of powder, and people would go to them and do rituals, and I had no idea what it all meant. So I became somewhat inspired to read a little bit more about the tradition and the culture that was connected to all this. It was unavoidable after everything I had seen. Subsequently, I began to see that there was a very deep tradition. I saw that there was a huge body of scriptures, not just one book, but really a library of books dealing with a very large range of topics. And that here we dealt with a culture which was highly developed thousands of years ago and had its own medical science, had its own architectural science, had many different aspects of science and culture. So it was interesting. For example, as I was reading one of the Vedic textbooks on medicinal sciences, then I noticed that there was a system for determining fractures in bones by applying a particular bandage mixed in with a certain mixture of herbs, which then, after a while, would show a red line on the bandage exactly where the fracture was. So when I read that, I was highly impressed. I was thinking, this is better than x-rays, right? X-rays, after all, everyone knows you get zapped and you wonder what it does. It may show a nice picture, but then again, what does it do to the body? So, in many ways, I felt that it was impressive that they had a system to deal with these kind of things, which was effective and healthy and so on. So, as I read further in these scriptures, in the science of Ayurveda. Ayurveda is the medical aspect of the Vedas which deals with Ayur, long life. So Ayurveda, literally translated from Sanskrit, means knowledge about a long life. And the whole principle of Ayurveda is to make the body healthy, right? Which is different than Western medical science. Basically, it's like whenever you get sick, then you give some medicine to suppress those symptoms, and then after a while that medicine makes you sick, and then you need a medicine to suppress the symptoms of the medicine, and like this it goes on, and it's a whole business. It works well. It keeps the economy going, so we can't complain. That is how it is all set up, consuming, producing, and so on. So this is part of our system. So Ayurveda appeared to be quite holistic. It was a approach to health which seemed to be interesting. The idea was to make a person healthy, and the idea was when you're healthy, you don't get sick. Only people who are in principle unhealthy, they get sick. Those people whose natural resistance to disease is so low that the slightest germ will catch them, they are the ones who get sick. But when the natural resistance is high, one doesn't get sick. That's interesting. And so I appreciated that aspect. But that was not everything. There were other aspects to Vedic culture which were more philosophical. One experience I had on my first journey in India, which I will not lightly forget, was that I had a confrontation with death. Not my death, but someone else's. One, I was in Benares, and an old beggar, he was lying dead one day in the street. So as I saw this body lying in the street, people were walking by. There was no ambulance, there was nothing like that. It just the crowd was just walking past. And as they were walking past, I was the only one who stood and watched. Everyone put his hand in his pocket and threw some coins on the body. And in about 10-15 minutes, the whole body was covered in coins. And I was thinking, this is far out. This man has never seen so much money in his life. Yeah? And now he's dead, he's being buried in money. What is this? Right? Are they fulfilling his last desire? So I was inquiring from someone, what is it all about? And they said, well, when somebody dies, then that person goes out of the body looks down upon the body and cannot enter. And so everyone says, oh, he's dead. He says, no, I'm not dead, I'm alive. But nobody hears him. He cannot go back inside, and he tries to go back in that body. He said, for that reason, traditionally, the body must be burned quickly, so that then this person can go on to his next destination and will not keep on hovering over the body. He has to now go on to the next, whatever that is, the next destination. And that since this man was poor and had no money for firewood, everyone gives a little bit so that the wood can be purchased and that his body can be burned quickly. And I was shocked. Right? What a culture. Right? If I compare that with the West, if I think of Switzerland, the land of the Red Cross, they will send a plane to the other side of the planet to save any of their citizens. Right? If any Swiss citizen falls sick somewhere on the other side of the world, in Africa, a plane will come from Switzerland to bring him back and to give him the best medical treatment. Millions of dollars are spent to save a life in the West. Not in the East, no. They didn't spend anything. But after he was dead, they suddenly started to spend money on saving his soul. Right? So it was, for me, a total culture shock, and I'm sure for all of you, the same. Now, instead of adding values to it and starting comparing and say which culture is better, our culture or their culture, instead of doing that, let us just observe the cultures, let us observe the differences and understand the differences and see what the values are that we can learn from other cultures. So anyhow, I definitely started to think by this particular incident, and therefore I was intrigued to read more Vedic literatures. And when I came across the Bhagavad Gita, then in the Bhagavad Gita I found a philosophy that was very, very similar to what these people in the street there had told me, that at the time of death one goes out of the body and looks down upon it, etc. I found a similar philosophy in the Gita, where it says that, first of all, the soul never takes birth, the soul never dies. Jayate mriyate va kadachin. So that understanding is central in the Eastern way of thinking, that there is a soul that never dies, and that soul becomes attracted to matter, and then at the time when there's conception, when a man and woman unite and there's conception, then at that time it says a soul enters. Right? So when the biological union takes place, then the soul comes in, and then one is in the gross body. Then the soul has become embodied, like a passenger in a car. Right? And different color cars and different models, etc. Small ones, big ones, and so on. Different types of bodies. So this is the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. And that was certainly interesting. Because we find that in our own Western tradition, we find a similar belief. This belief of a soul continuing to exist separate from the body. The concept of an afterlife is not at all alien to Western culture and Western tradition. The same thing. We look further around the world, and when we look in Africa, then there is worship of the forefathers. And there is the idea that after death, the forefathers are accompanying those who are living, and some are helping, and some are causing trouble. Right? And this is the idea. And there are certain sacrifices done to appease those who are causing trouble and to gain the favor of those who are helping. And in this way, there is a whole culture of worship of the ancestors. And this is a big thing in Africa. So, again, ancestor worship implies the same thing, life after death. So that remains a big question. In the Western world, with the Renaissance, we saw how rationalism set in. And as rationalism set in, that question of life after death became something that was difficult to prove, right? And became something just based on belief. But what was the factual basis for such belief? And all these kind of convictions and beliefs have since been put into question by so many people. And therefore, the question whether there is life after death or whether there is a soul remained for many philosophers a question that is unanswerable. Therefore, one cannot truly ever prove such a question or such a phenomena, and therefore it was felt by the pragmatists that such philosophy, such questions are irrelevant. Let's not bother with them. And many people took that model in life. Me too. I also came from that background where I said the question whether there is life after death, whether there is a God or not, or all these kind of questions. We'll never figure it out. And there's no, really no point in pondering on these things. Right. So I left it at that. But then in India, I was confronted with another paradigm. A paradigm that has also existed here somewhat earlier. A paradigm where everyone was totally fixed in a conviction that everything is controlled by a God who is the ultimate supreme intelligence, the ultimate origin of everything that exists, who is behind everything, and that everything was going on by some divine plan and divine arrangement. That we find very strongly in the East still today. The scientific world will not so easily accept such a thing, right? Because the whole approach is based on the principle that, well, unless you can present proof, right, unless you can present proof, why would we accept it? Right? That logic is very clearly said to us. Well, if you can't prove it in some way or other, then that's your belief is simply sentimental, right? And there's absolutely no certainty that there is fact about it. Right? It's just a belief, and belief without reason, what is the value of it? So is this is more or less the opinion of Mother Man. Right? Fine. We are ready to roll with that. But there is one complication, and that complication is that there is also absolutely no proof that there is no life after death, and that there is no God. Right? One can also not prove that. When I meet an atheist, then I'm very pleased to meet a believer. I congratulate such, and I said, finally, in this day and age, when everyone is full of doubt, and when nobody knows anything for sure, it is so nice to meet someone who really has a conviction, who has a strong belief. It is so rare to find a believer. How nice to find an atheist, a man with a firm faith. Congratulations. They usually don't like that. And that, of course, I like very much. What can I say? So it's a favorite pastime. This point, though, is there that there is no evidence against nor evidence in favor. This is actually the point. Therefore, if we are reading ancient scriptures from ancient traditions and so on, these are testimonies of a particular time and culture that existed so many thousands of years ago, and with people who were equally intelligent as we are today, right?
and who had their sources of information. Sometimes there is the idea that man is gradually progressing, and that it all started with cavemen, right, who used to be half man, half animal, and go out there with a piece of wood in the hand, a club, and hit dinosaurs over the head, etc. And then find some lady and grab her by the hair and drag her into the cave. And so on, right? And that gradually, slowly, we have progressed, right? That we have progressed, and that we have come to modern man, who is very civilized and eats with knife and fork, and everything goes on, and it's high tech, and everything at the push of a button, and we laugh at the fears of that primitive man. It's night, haha, turn on the light. It's nothing to us. Oh, it's bad weather out there. Yes, it is. Turn up the thermostat, right? Modern man can so easily deny all these natural forces, and with that lose his own sense of insignificance. But when you live in a little hut and the roof is shaking in a thunderstorm, boy, you start praying, whatever is up there, you know, save us. Not our hut, please, not our hut tonight. Ba-boom! Oh my God, that was the big tree, right? Not far from here, and like that. But we are living well protected by our lightning conductors, and even the highest points are well protected. We are safe from all these things. Science will save us. Science will save us. Well, will science save us? Not so many years ago, there was a meteorite that hit Jupiter, and it said it left a crater which was much bigger than planet Earth. What if such a meteor would come for our planet? What would be left of it? No problem. The astronomers, they will know it way in advance, and they'll let us know, and then we'll simply call George Bush, and he'll arrange for the thing to be shot out of the sky. No problem. The Americans will do it. Right? So they rang up the astronomers and asked them. It was a TV program where these questions were asked. They rang up the astronomers and asked them, well, what if such a meteorite would come down? Would we be able to see it? He said, well, you know, you have to understand, they said, that there are quite a number of big observatories, but then if you look at the entire range of the sky, it is so vast, we cannot by far cover the whole thing. There's no way. You know, we would have to cover the whole Earth with observatories in order to have a good view. And even then, something might slip in between. And with the observatories we have, we really wouldn't be sure if we would see that meteorite. Oh, and if we would see it, then maybe minutes before it would land. Oh. But anyway, the army will shoot it out of the sky with laser beams, no problem. We call the army. Yes. Okay, yes, you are a general in the U.S. Army. Yes, I am. Okay, great news. Right, so we have this meteorite, and just so you guys, you'll just blow it out of the sky, isn't it? You know, just with laser beams, right? U.S. laser beams. Right. The general said, well, imagine you have a football field, and you put near the goal, you put one man with a gun, and on the middle line, on the side, you put another man, not in the middle, but on the side. Huh? And the man from the goal shoots a bullet across the football field. And the man in the middle, he has to, with his gun, shoot that bullet out of the sky. Not so easy. Oh boy. So it's not sure that science will save us from the meteorite that will come on our head. No, it's not. Was the conclusion of the program, and they left it with that.
Yes.
We feel so secure.
Doctor.
Doctor.
Right.
There must be something you can do.
No, sorry. 2 months is all you have.
No, but I'm sure there's a cure.
Not here. You can go, maybe, to a voodoo doctor in Brazil. Right. It is like that sometimes, right, in this world. Modern science is also not all-powerful.
And yes, we have made progress.
Right.
Yes, we have made progress. And nowadays, if we compare our knowledge to the knowledge of the caveman, then his knowledge was just like a tiny little area. But our knowledge is as vast as a... Just on the plane there was a man sitting next to me with a book of Bill Bryson, Something About Everything, right? And it was all about science, and it was describing how there are bacteria who, when they are being bombarded by radioactivity, disintegrate, because the radioactive waves will destroy the coherence of the atom, and the protons and the neutrons go all over the place, and then this bacteria, these protons and neutrons will just reassemble back. Such bacteria we have. So science tells us very interesting little details. They know so many things about so many things. So it seems that in modern times the knowledge that modern man has is so much more than that we had before, and that just now we are on the peak of civilization, that there is no level beyond where we are now. Mankind has come on the peak of his actual understanding of reality. Sometimes we think like that. And our area of knowledge has now become not a small little island, but it has become a vast continent. Now what I like to present to you, it is a continent, fair enough, it's a continent, but it is a drifting continent. A drifting continent in the sense that whatever progress we are making in terms of knowledge, simultaneously, we're forgetting the tradition. Our great-grandmother knew how to take certain herbs from the forest, and she could cure diseases with that. Don't ask me, right? I always thought potatoes grow in plastic bags, right? Until I was 20, right? On a shelf in the supermarket. Because I was born in a city, little did I know, the first time I saw a cow, and I saw that the milk came out of that, I gave up milk for 1 week. Right? I said, like, oh God, you know. And I saw the stooly backside so close to the place where my milk came from. And I thought, oh no, oh God, you know. I didn't, what can I do? I understand that in Wagga Wagga maybe people would shake their head, but what can you do when you come from an urban area and you grow up like that? Right? Later, I stayed here in Australia, in the outback somewhere, at a large station near Mildura, so I've seen something of countryside also, and I appreciate the countryside. Now I know what a potato plant looks like, but still, we have lost something. In traditional times, people had so much knowledge, which we don't have today. So have we really made progress? This is one question I'm making. Or are we simply shifting our knowledge from one thing to another? And as we are finding out so many new things, learning so many new things, we're forgetting so many things at the same time. And daily, so much knowledge and tradition is getting lost. America is exporting one thing, and it's its culture, or lack of culture, and Mickey Mouse goes everywhere, right, nowadays. In India also, they had Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse came by plane, flew into India, and was welcomed there in a traditional way by offering of incense and garlands, just as they worship in the temple. And I'm sure it won't be long before there will be Mickey Mouse temples, right, in India. So the point being that all over the world, the original culture is dying out, and we are getting that one same homogeneous culture all over the world. I'm not passing judgment, right? Just as I asked you in the beginning not to pass any judgment about the situation with the dying man or the dead man in the street, and whether the Western approach to send in the Red Cross to save him or the Eastern approach to try and save his soul was the best. No judgment, just see the differences in culture. In the same way, I'm also not going to pass judgment which culture is better, East or West, but I just wanted to point out that if we think that now mankind is at the height of its progress, then we might be mistaken, because of this drifting continent phenomenon, that yes, we are finding out new things and very rapidly forgetting so much. So therefore, it is very interesting to delve deep into ancient cultures. So we're seeing that the ancient cultures before the Industrial Revolution were more spiritually oriented than the culture of today. We see that practically all over the world at that time, the orientation was religious, predominantly so. And we find that in modern times, that is much less so. At least traditional religions have less attention than ever, right, in the Western world. But then we see that so many alternative things are coming up. So many alternative things are coming up. By people are now into crystals, into earth lines, into chakras, and into all kinds of things, a pyramid, right, and so many other things that are considered to be spiritual. So looking at all these varieties of culture which I have sketched, and with some question marks about the progress and the superiority of our modern day culture over other traditions, it is interesting to look a little further than our own known culture. So if we look in traditional cultures, then it is stated that pure rationalism as a source of knowledge, as the source of finding out reality, is inadequate. They say this is unnatural, this is artificial. To try and establish an objective truth, right, is considered to be false and artificial, because the point is being made that objectivity doesn't exist. We are always subjective beings. We can never switch off intuition and feelings, right? It's like certain signals are coming in, right? Just as we go around the curve of an unknown street, immediately there are certain feelings about this street. I don't know what it is, this street, but something awkward. I mean, this vulture sitting on that branch there, I don't know exactly what the point is of that, but it does something with my spine. Yes. So there are so many signs that we read, so many impressions that we have beyond pure rationalism that give us an indication of what is going on. And therefore, to just base our knowledge on rationalism only is considered to be very narrow. In psychology, certainly, it is said that intuition and belief and all these factors
are also considered as essential elements in consciousness. So, the Bhagavad Gita, however, is quite a scientific book. It is a very scientific book because it does not ask anyone to believe anything. Although it's making statements, it said there is a soul, it is said we are never born, we never die, there is a God who is in control of everything. It does not ask anyone to believe, but it simply asks for suspension of disbelief. It must begin with that. You cannot approach the book and say it's not true, because then you are like the atheist. A believer, I'm a believer. No. So it's not for believers. It's for objective, for those who want to try and approach the matter objectively by saying that, well, I don't know. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Now, the Bhagavad Gita, besides making statements about the soul being eternal, about God being in control, and statements like that, the Bhagavad Gita, beyond that, is offering a process for getting a direct experience of this reality. And that process is called yoga. So yoga is not what we know, you know, and bend your back and stretch your leg and touch your toes and so on, right? And now sit in the Padma Asana, and now sit in this asana and that asana, and this is good for digestion, and this helps the respiratory organs, and so on. No, it is not merely for that. Yoga, originally, interesting enough, has roots in Sanskrit, and the roots are of the word yuktena. Yuktena means to connect. So if we look at the word religion, it is interesting because it comes from this Latin religare, which is the same, to reconnect. So that's interesting. Yoga and religion have the same translation. Anyway, so the purpose of yoga was to reconnect, right? To connect with the spiritual origin in life. So it has a spiritual context, yoga, which, anyway, Bhagavad Gita introduces yoga and explains various types of yoga as a process by which one can realize the philosophy of the eternity of the soul and the existence of the Supreme Lord. And it said if you follow that system of yoga, then in due course of time, there will be a change of consciousness, a change of perception, and then one will be able to directly perceive God face to face. Not as a philosophical idea, but directly, direct experience thereof. Right. Now you may say, like, well, you know, okay, interesting. But, you know, there are homes for people who are seeing all kinds of things, right? And, you know, when they start seeing too many things, then you usually call that number, and then, you know, there is a vehicle coming to take them away. Like that, right? So, you know, it's all good and well. There are many people who have realized that they are Napoleon, and there are many that have realized they are Jesus Christ. Whenever you go into some insane asylum, there's always a few Jesus Christ there, you know, at any time, right? Simultaneously. And may the real Jesus stand up, right? It gets confusing. It's like a TV program. Who's the real one? None of them. We are afraid to say so. Right? It's all imaginary, a sign of madness. So, if through a process followed in the Bhagavad Gita, a process of yoga, one can directly perceive God, okay, how do we know it's not a hallucination? How do we know it's not just an artificial state of mind? How do we know it's not just some sort of madness? It's a good question to ask. Well, let us compare the state of consciousness that is described of the person who has followed the yoga system and then gets the direct experience of God and his symptoms. Let us compare those with the symptoms of one who has, who is in a psychosis, and see if it resembles a psychosis. Any psychosis is subjected to both manic and depressive periods, right? There is a moment when the psychotic person is all powerful. He has now just realized that he is the one who has been sent and empowered to save the world from an invasion of the Martians. And the Martians are here, and he is the only one who knows, and he will now save the earth. And the Martians have just landed in a spaceship which is very sinister and disguised like this piece of furniture. You may think, right, it's an ordinary piece of furniture, but I'm telling you, it's a spaceship from Mars. Where are the matches? Bring the matches. Act casual. Bring the matches. Right, okay. We have to burn it. Ayoja, do you have any matches? Quick, quick, quick. Act normal, act normal. Just as if nothing's going on. But casually go out, bring some matches, a little kerosene, right? And we'll just fix up these fellows with the antennas once and for all, right? Okay, you know. So Ayoja goes out to bring the matches. It takes a long time. Meanwhile, he rings up the guy. There's a bloke here, you know, like, and goes, I couldn't find any matches, but I sent someone to the shop to bring some, right? Yeah, and like that, right? So, generally speaking, we see in the manic period a person is very powerful, right, in his psychosis. But then he goes into another stage, into a stage of depression, a stage of paranoia, a stage of fear, right? He is getting totally overwhelmed. Now the Martians are still not gone, although the thing is burned, and they appear through the wall, and the Martians are now manifesting on his hand, and he's very tense, and he smokes cigarettes, and he burns that Martian face. And he does it again. I actually saw once someone like that who was burning the devil out of his body. And then on the burns on his hand, he said, that's the face of the devil. And then he burned it again. Oh my God, it was hellish. Right. So psychosis is not a funny thing. Psychosis is a very sad state of consciousness where there's intense suffering. Oh yes, sometimes they laugh like anything, the crazies, but other times it's not just fun, right? There are times when it's all really deep, deep suffering. So up and down, very extreme in psychosis, very extreme. So what is the consciousness of one who has perfected and who at them. Some people burn candles in the church for saintly personalities. And what are the descriptions of these saintly personalities? That they are always peaceful and always inspired and so on. Same. Hey, interesting. We see some similarities in the different traditions of the world, describing a certain stage of consciousness which is there in those who are self-realized. So, if it's an artificial state of consciousness, it doesn't resemble the symptoms of psychosis at all.
So that makes it a little difficult. If it was artificial, someone should snap out of it every once in a while and just lose it. Right? But that is not the case. So, in this way, we are seeing circumstantial evidence, right, which is supportive of the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita, and which may not be sufficient to completely convince the toughest agnostic that we may encounter. But for a person who's open-minded, he might say, well, an indication that might be worth an experiment. After all, isn't that modern science? You have an idea, you have a theory, and then, well, take it to the laboratory and start mixing things and start get some cultures there and see what grows in the laboratory, and then do a few tests and see what happens. And when the tests seem to indicate that the theory is correct, aha, then we can present a paper and possibly even get a grant, right, for further research. Whoa. And the whole academic world functions on that. Grants, right? Big grants. Grants. Give us a couple of grants. Yeah, like that. So, isn't that the way we operate? Therefore, Bhagavad Gita is a very interesting scripture. It is indeed worth an investigation. We became impressed by it, obviously, otherwise why would we sit here today in oriental robes, right, or in Vedic robes rather, traditional Vedic robes. We became at one point so impressed by it that we decided, yes, we will stand for this. Of course, nowadays, the Hare Krishna movement, not everyone walks around like me. Sometimes people say, we never see you guys anymore. No wonder, because once there was a time when every Hare Krishna was 20 years old and walking around in the pink dress because everyone was unmarried, and pink stands for celebrant. But then most got married, and sometimes on a Friday program they dress up in the costume, but most of the time they really don't, and most of them have jobs and kids, as we're having here, you know, a family father. Yoja, how many kids do you have?
Three
kids. How old are they? 12 year old, then. And what do you do for a living?
Works in the bank.
Okay, well, a yogi besides working in the bank is also an actor, and I always ask him in every program to do a little act about working in the bank. So just we're going to have a 5-minute break, and I turn over the floor. A little round of applause.
I think it's only like now you're talking about culture. When I first left school, I also worked in a bank in the 1974. At that time, my consciousness, this story as we're talking about tonight, is different levels of consciousness. When I first joined the bank in 1974, I had no concept of spirituality, no understanding, no concern, as Maharaj pointed out in the beginning of class. The existence or non-existence of God was actually the furthest thing from my consciousness. I just left school, thought, go out and get a job. So then I used to engage in a lot of different types of activities. It was very difficult actually trying to work in a bank while under the influence of marijuana. to try and calculate and get things out and say hello if you could imagine. The manager would come out and say, how are you going today, Andrew? And I'd be going, today? Where am I? What's going on? And different things like that. So now, when I talk to people in the bank, even if my job is to, I'm a teller, so my job is to, people come in, give me their money, I give them money. But in the process, I try to engage them in some sort of consciousness uplifting. However small, however little, however much it takes, if someone's coming from India, I ask them, I'm from India, if someone talks about school, I ask them, what are they learning, what are they studying? The funny thing happens to me sometimes like that in a bank where my fellow co-workers, they come up to me and go, Andrew, yes, you're a Hare Krishna, aren't you? Yes. You like smoking marijuana, don't you? No. And so, but don't Hare Krishna, you know, take drugs? I'm saying no, I don't think so. I mean, again, the option is there, someone may do it, they may not. That's up to the individual. We're not forced to do anything, we have to make that point very clear. I can take drugs if I want to, but I don't want to, because that's what I say, that was my response to them. I said, since I've become a Hare Krishna devotee, the change in my consciousness that I perceive is fantastic. It's a wonderful life. And they say to me, well, aren't you into free love? And I'm married to three children. I don't think my wife would appreciate it. Free love. So no, no, so we're not into that. Then they just shake their head and go, wow, we thought you were a bit of a, you know, bit of a number, a bit of an act, something, you know, something really good. And I just say, no. Again, it's the same thing. The consciousness is a wonderful consciousness, a wonderful state of consciousness. And some of them actually appreciate that. Some of them come up to me and they go, Andrew, we're amazed at how, no matter what happens, never appear stress, you never appear in anxiety, you never appear worried over anything. And as Maharaj said, I'm a bit of an accident. So, yes, I do get a little anxiety, I do get disturbed, I do get upset and disappointed, but I know how to handle it. That's the thing about Krishna consciousness. It's not that these things are going to disappear, but while someone else is running around wondering and scrambling their brains of what to do, I know within myself I've got a peacefulness within myself that helps me in those times of distress, helps me in those times of anxiety, that I can go through it very simply, very methodically, very realistically, and it helps me and it also helps those around me. You know, because all the other bank officers in the bank appreciate my presence being here because they know that I, because of the Christian consciousness that I actually give out, however little it is, helps them in their day. And they appreciate, I'm 2 weeks holiday at the moment, they appreciate it and they're saying, I hope you come back soon because there's an air of Christian consciousness that they actually appreciate even though they may not be aware of. Some of them come up and ask me questions like, Andrew, because I know I'm a vegetarian, so they say, Andrew, like when you go past a barbecue, don't you feel hungry? I say, you know, I mean, I could really say something smart or something.
Say something smart.
Say something smart like, oh, God, that's dumb. I want to puke. No, I wouldn't say that. All I'd say is, that's not smart. Smart and clever is a different thing. I wouldn't say anything to upset or offend them or disturb them in any way. I just turn my head and say, no, I wouldn't feel like that. I don't feel hungry. I feel that I've chosen and by the grace of God, by the grace of the days and situation I was in, somehow or other, I find that I feel it's a great blessing that I've changed my consciousness. It's not some religious fervor sort of thing. I know what I was. I used to live in Liverpool and I used to live in Bondi. And I would think twice in my earlier days of life of while everyone's sitting in this room talking, I would go outside and break into the cars and steal into the bedroom without the slightest concern in any way, shape, or form. And so now I see how my character is being reformed, and I want to give that gift to Isaac to God. That's why I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, so a man who lives in the world and who somehow or other followed the Bhagavad Gita in his life since many years, and finds that that following that process gives a change of consciousness, who may not have gone to the highest levels of perfection, but who gets great inspiration from following knowledge of spiritual depth. So, what do we want, actually? Why are we here? Let me just end with that. I think what we really want is to... two things. One is we want to get out of the image of being extraterrestrials, right? We would like to be, or oddballs, right? We'd like to be accepted as people who are genuine, who are following a certain culture with values, who have their convictions, their beliefs, etc., who are ready to accept that others have other beliefs, but at the same time who feel that they have a positive contribution to make to the world. And this is what we want to offer, a positive contribution to the world. We think that if everyone would find a little more satisfaction internally instead of looking so much for satisfaction outside himself by getting the latest of the latest state of the art at a high price. Instead of looking outside ourselves, if we look within and find some satisfaction there, that will improve life a lot. For the rest, life goes on. He told me that a couple of days ago in the bank, he pushed by mistake the alarm button, right, accidentally. And the metal shutters just within seconds whoosh, flew up. Right? I wish I could have seen it because I've always wanted to. But yeah, it's interesting to hear about that. I've always wondered what happens in a bank when they push the alarm button. Now I know there are metal shutters that fly up in front of the counters and other things like that. So it's not. That life has suddenly become very dry, but one no longer needs to get zonked, as they say in Australia, I think, or other things like that, because one finds some other type of satisfaction. So spirituality has a place in life, and without it, there's emptiness, which has to be filled with something else. Right. If there's no spirituality in our life, then we must fill it with material things. And if there is spirituality, then we can easily live without so much materialism. So in that way, I think that sometimes it is said that the East is the lame and the West is the blind. Right. And when the lame and blind combine, then we get the perfect situation. So lame in the sense that the East, materially speaking, it's just not happening. In the West, there's just no time to think in life. We are too busy, too caught up from morning till night, and then when you come home, no more energy left, just push on that button and look at that thing. Because there's no energy after a whole day work. So in this way we are seeing that if we want to actually conquer stress and anxiety, which was in the title of the lecture. The title is so long that I couldn't remember it. I'm sorry for that. Bad memory. But anyway, it was about stress and anxiety and the secret of how to overcome stress and anxiety. And the true secret is by following a process of yoga and reconnecting with our spiritual origin, the Supreme Lord, and understanding our eternal nature. Then we get peace within. When there's peace within, then one has a natural strength to deal with all the anxieties of the world. And one will not be so affected. And the more elevated one becomes spiritually, the less one will be affected by anything else. Okay, with that, I'm ending my talk this evening. I'm thanking you for attending our program. I hope you found it of interest. Our program will continue with a vegetarian meal, which will be served at the end, outside in the foyer, because in this area it is not permitted to serve any foodstuffs. But before we go on to that part of the program, I'd like to ask you if there are any questions or responses that you would have to what we have presented, or any thoughts that you would like to express. It's sometimes very nice to have some interaction. You know, I drink a little water too. Yeah.
I'm interested in the dialogue between life and soul.
Yeah.
And where he sees it. How do you conceptualize?
Uh-huh. Okay. from the East, right, there many philosophies have reached us, of course. Since the 60s, so much have come from India to the West. And there are in India different kinds of philosophies. So one philosophy coming from India describes how there is an impersonal force which is spiritual and all-pervading, and that is what you are referring to, she, he, or it, right? And this is known in Sanskrit as Brahman. It is said this all-pervading energy is the source on which everything rests. Yeah. So in philosophical terms, you would call that monism. Right? You would say the idea that everything is one, and the idea that all variety ultimately is a manifestation of the one same spiritual energy. In Western tradition, there is another understanding. There's theism. Right? There's the idea there's God, and he has a distinct identity, and there is the living being, and he has a distinct identity. So in India, there are also schools who are theistic. Right? So we are actually into a theistic approach of God. So we have the idea that that there is a God, one God, and then many innumerable living entities who are eternally connected with him, but who are always in the position of dependence, and that one person is the supplier of all. Yeah. In the idea of monism, the idea is that we should give up our identity, and then we can merge with that one spiritual energy, and then in the end we come into some sort of pool, and then everything is all one, and we are also part of that. Right? That is another
philosophy that exists in India, and it has reached the West many times. But we are closer to the Western idea, in the sense that we say there is one God, and that God certainly also has a form, we're saying. See, the idea is God must be the origin of everything that exists. So therefore form must be also included with him. Also the formless energy must also be included within him. So there is his energy and his form, and in our understanding we accept both, that he has form and energy. So not just an all-pervading energy or an all-pervading intelligence, but also form. After all, we have energy, we have intelligence, and we have form, but it is all limited. We have limited energy, limited intelligence, limited form. He has unlimited energy, unlimited intelligence, and unlimited form. What should we imagine in unlimited form? Maybe that's beyond our conception. Maybe the human brain does not have the full capacity to figure out God. Maybe he is greater than we could ever conceive of, but something we can conceive. And therefore it is said that if we try to figure it out by dint of our own intellect, we may find that at one point we get stuck. And therefore it is said the best is if the knowledge comes down from self-realized persons. And there comes in the concept of guru. And that's where in the East this whole idea of guru comes from. From a self-realized person, a teacher who's supposed to reveal, let's say, the other dimension. He is an other, he has a connection with that other dimension. And therefore he can reveal it. And we see, of course, that in the Western tradition, in one sense, Jesus also acted like that. Like a person who had a connection with the other dimension, and was then sending that, transmitting that into our world. So this is the idea. On our own we cannot understand the nature of God, but we accept he has his energy, all-pervading intelligence, and yet is also a person, and always unlimited. There's a lot more, but then again I would have to start another lecture, so we have to save that for another evening, I'm afraid, because too much of something good is not good anymore. Just like you have a nice cake, and you know, if you eat too much of a nice cake, then after a while it becomes misery. So we don't want to spoil it by dishing out too much. If you try and conceive of God all at once, yes, then it becomes too much of a good thing. One must take it just like food. Whatever we take in, we must digest. So you cannot just, you know, just like you cannot read the whole Bible. You know, nobody can sit down and read the Bible from cover to cover non-stop. Somewhere in the middle, you know, it just, whew, boy, I need a break, need some fresh air, let's turn on the TV, let's do something else. No one can just assimilate all that information and process it. The idea is not just to read it, but to assimilate it, think about it, realize it, understand how it's logical, how it makes sense. That takes time. Therefore, I think for tonight we've had our dose, if you ask me. Maybe even more than maybe already quite a bit. So I don't want to prolong it. I thank you once again for being with us this evening. And we have time for some informal discussion while we are serving the meals. And I think we should just take a little break. And is everything ready over there for serving out? Everything is ready. So I hope you are also ready. Thank you very, very much. And I hope you have a little appetite, because they've cooked all kinds of things.
and we do have some reputation as kitchen religion, so you have to sample that. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hope to see you again in the future.